Ian Kinsler at the plate, 0 for 4 on the afternoon. Swings at the first pitch and a line drive to left field. Caught by Lonnie Chisenhall. It's over. 21 in a row. The Cleveland Indians have set a new record for the longest win streak in American League history.
I mean, I think they're enjoying themselves. They should. I think what's kind of cool about our game is when you do things and you do them the right way. You know, like with a hitting streak, somebody hits 3-0 when you're down 5 runs. And our guys are playing the game to win the right way. That part's really meaningful. They should enjoy what they're doing. It's pretty special.
Everybody's contributing, enjoying the game. Everybody's happy to be here. I really truly believe that they're capable of helping the team. And whenever they step into the play or they feel like they can do something to help the team that day, and that's exactly what we're doing.
Man, I couldn't be happier. I couldn't ask for any more. I feel at home here. I feel like this, this is where I should be.
There's a bunch of things that I think are in Cleveland's favor. Personally, I would actually just love to see them do it. This is already a great story for baseball. I don't think any of the teams that has won 20 straight in a regular season has ever won the World Series, so it certainly doesn't promise that you're going to. But in and of itself, it's a good story for baseball. It means now lots of people are going to be watching Cleveland games.
It's the most dominant stretch of baseball that I've seen in my lifetime. Plus 104 run differential. First three innings of games, they've outscored their opponents 68-13. They are crushing teams in a way that you see in college football and you do not see in baseball. I think they're the best team in baseball. I think that's been demonstrated. You know, I would love to give Terry Francona some truth serum because, you know, let's say that they do get to 27 straight wins. I bet you after that, Terry probably would like to see them lose a game because the streak has become a thing. You know, once it plays out, he'd love to get them refocused on the postseason, but I don't think that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, I think when things aren't going well, you go back to fundamentals. It's so early in the season, though. We're going to be balanced. We're going to do whatever we have to do to go win this game. A lot of it's are we blocking them? Are they loading the line of scrimmage? We're going to do what we have to do to go win the game. We cannot be one-dimensional. We're working awful hard at that. I thought it went pretty well. Game one, struggled in the first half, but ended up with 600 yards and 49 points against on the road in a Big Ten game. Last week, I did not think it went well, so it's obviously a work in progress. You know, he is the primary play caller. We have to do better.
It's only two games into knowing the personnel, knowing what you guys do, or should it be better?
Should be much better.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed to the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Hope you're having an outstanding start to your day today. Now, what am I saying? It's 3:11. You're close to the end of your day today. But hope you're having a good one no matter what you want to call it. Boy, the streak continues to be the story in the sporting scene nationally. And obviously in Ohio too. I mean, this is when you watch baseball as long as a guy like Buster Olney has, and that's one of the guys that you heard there at the end, and he says this is the best stretch of baseball I've ever seen in my lifetime. It's saying something. You know, I saw a really interesting discussion about that this morning, and about where the Indians are. And this 21-game run, and whether or not they can make it 22 and have sole possession of second place all time. They already have first place all time in the American League now, but if they can break that tie with the 1935 Cubs and win 22 in a row. And I just, you know, saw some guys today talking, and I can't remember what show it was on. Putting that into perspective, they were saying, look, nobody alive really has ever experienced this and known it and understood it. If you were alive in 1935 and watching baseball, chances are you were watching it as a six-year-old. You know, if you're in your 80s and you were born, let's say, in 1928, 29, 30, somewhere in that neighborhood, and you're watching baseball in 1935, you're a child. You're there's no watching it. There's no TV. It's if you're paying attention to baseball. How's that? If you're paying attention to baseball in 1935, you're a child. You know, you're not able to appreciate and or understand this. That's the kind of history we're talking about. The kind of history we're talking about is the kind where nobody alive today has ever seen anything quite like this, let alone the 1916. Now, that's 101 years ago. The 1916 New York Giants, who won the 26th in a row, disputed by some, but I think we clarified that pretty well yesterday, that according to Elias, they wiped that game out. That tie in the middle of their 26-game winning streak did not register as a tie because the game didn't count. They started it over the next day as part of a doubleheader, and the Giants won both of them, so the streak continued on to 26 consecutive games. But that was 1916. When you talk about some of the numbers, and I'm not going to dive all the way through them like I did a little bit on yesterday's show, right after, you know, win number 21 happened, that game ended literally right as we were turning the mics on to start the show yesterday. So we gave you a lot of those numbers then, but just to throw one at you, you know, the 104 run differential in the streak alone, plus 104 in the streak alone, is the type of thing that has not happened in a baseball run or in a single baseball season since the 1939 Yankees, regarded as one of the greatest baseball teams of all time. And again, I think it was Buster. It might have been, I don't remember exactly who was talking about this, was saying that, again, 1935, 1939, 1916, nobody alive today remembers any of that. If you're a baseball historian, you can look it up and say, oh, wow, look at that. Look at that streak. Look at that. Nobody lived through it. Nobody experienced it. Nobody watched it on a regular basis, night by night, television and on radio all the time. Reliving it on social media and on sports websites. Nobody did that. Nobody has ever seen this before, and I hope people truly understand. This is a lot different than, you know, in my opinion, than let's just say, you know, the Patriots going through, how long has it been now, Jim? 8 years, 9 years since the Patriots went undefeated in the regular season?
Yeah, gosh, that was 9 years ago. That was the 08. Yeah, that was 08.
So, you know, so wow. Isn't that hard to believe?
Yeah.
That's different going 16-0 in a football season. Obviously, it would have been historic for them to finish it out, and they didn't. Don't get me wrong, but playing once a week is different than playing every bleeping night. And when you get into a streak like this, Jim, what makes this to me so spectacular and so impossible is the fact that it happened in late August and now through September when, you know, teams that have had rainouts have to make them up this late in the season. And sometimes you get through a run where you don't get a day off for two solid weeks. You're playing, you know, 14 games in 15 nights kinds of things, where it's just on and on and on and on. And to continue to roll as in such a dominant fashion as they have, again, nobody has ever experienced this before in baseball. Not Tim Kirkjian, not Buster Olney, not any of the SportsCenter guys, not any of the Baseball Tonight guys, not any of the writers, not any of the fans. I mean, not John Miller, not, you know, Joe Garagiola and Tony Kubek. And I'm just thinking of old time and long time, you know, broadcasters. Nobody has experienced this before. And I just really, really, I'm trying to soak it in as much as I can without sounding cheesy. Well, maybe it's too late. Maybe I sound cheesy. Without trying to sound cheesy, I'm trying to absorb as much of it as I can so that I have it in my memory so I can talk about it in years to come. Do you remember back in the summer of 2017? Do you remember when the Indians went on a run that had never been seen before or never experienced before anyway? Whether they get to the 1916 record of 26 straight or not is irrelevant to me. You know, if they win tonight, it's 22 in a row. If it's tomorrow, if it ends at 21, if it ends at 24, it doesn't matter. We're going to talk about the summer of 2017. And do you remember when, you know, entire, and I'm looking for a metaphor here, and I don't know if I can find what I was going to say. Just things happened. Enough time passed between losses for this team where it's very hard to comprehend. But I just, I do want to talk about one other thing about this, Jim, before we get into some other stories. And by the way, Sports Illustrated has come out with their top 100 in anticipation of NBA training camps, which start next month. They have their top 100 players in the National Basketball Association going into 2017-2018 season. It's very, very cool, and it's very interesting, and of course it's good for debate because there are some really debatable things on it. So I do want to get into that. We got a lot of college football next hour. We are going to talk with Paul Keels, the voice of the Buckeyes, about the Ohio State loss to Oklahoma at the Horseshoe and how that felt for Urban Meyer's group to have that happen with Baker Mayfield planting the flag and more importantly, how they respond against Army this week, and whether or not JT Barrett is going to have the confidence that he needs to lead this team where it wants to go. So that'll be Paul Keels at 4:10, then Jason Candle, head coach of your UT Rockets, will talk to us at about 4:35, 4:40 tonight, or on this program. So I do have some other things to get into, but just one other note on the baseball side, Jim, because I had Lodi on, it was, what, Tuesday, I think? Matt Lodi was on with us?
Yeah. It was Tuesday. Yeah, it was Tuesday.
And I asked him about the fans, and I asked him about the attendance there, and the fact that the Indians riding a 20-game winning streak, and in within this 20, you know, when it was, let's just say when it was 12, yeah, and it was a little tiny piddly 12-gamer. When it was 12, and it was like, oh my God, they're within two games of tying their franchise record for wins in a, you know, consecutive wins in a season, which they just set last year. Could they actually even 14? Could they actually match that? Maybe even beat that to get to 15? It seems like forever ago, and they're still going.
Yeah, the only thing I remember is they were on a long road trip at that point. Wins 1 through 4 on the streak came at home, then they went on the road.
There you go. Okay. So the point to that was, I was saying, you know, when it was 12, you know, Jim, and they came home, or whatever the number was when they came home, I mean, how is the place not packed? How are they getting 18,000 on a weekend game? How are they getting 21,000 in a park that holds 36 or 38 or whatever it is? How are you not just, you know, flocking if you're anywhere within the Cleveland area and even from across the state on the weekend games? You know, how are you not going to the ballpark to watch this in person and be part of this history and to watch this, you know, historically, you know, tremendous run happen? And I complained a little bit about the attendance because what did I say they were? 24th out of 30 teams, I think, in attendance.
Which sadly is an improvement over the last few years when they were like 29th.
Well, it is, but I mean, it's not
still
enough.
Too low. It's still too low.
It's not enough. I mean, they're trailing the Twins and the Tigers and the Royals and the, you know, a whole bunch of other teams that aren't doing anything anywhere near as much fun as they are, right? So I kind of complained about it, and I just happened across something today that I thought was interesting and worth sharing. Maybe I'm being a little harsh on the fans who are not going out there and providing them with the turnstile monies that they need in order to re-sign. You know how many of these guys they have on just bargain basement contracts? I mean, they are in such great shape.
Most
financially,
of them are signed for two more years on those contracts, too.
What's that?
A lot of them are signed for at least two more years on those contracts to boot.
Well, and that's true, but that's what I'm talking about. I'm looking at 2 years from now. Or 3 years from
gotcha,
now, depending
okay.
on the contract, or 4 years from now, whatever the case might be.
I follow you, okay.
In individual guys. For example, Corey Kluber, you know how much money he's making this year?
Isn't it like $8 million?
Very good, very good.
Oh, close.
$7.7 million. If Corey Kluber was a free agent right now, how much money would he be making?
Well, let's see. Verlander's contract is at 28, so I'm going at least 25.
Yeah, I would add 20 to the 7.7 he's getting now and say he'd probably get $27, $28 million a year to do what he is doing, which is just spectacular. Jose Ramirez, who might be the MVP of the American League, is making nothing, comparatively speaking. I mean, and Frankie Lindor is on a nice club-friendly contract for a few more years, too.
I think it's a year or two before he's even arbitration eligible.
Right. But you understand the point.
Yes.
The point of this is they're going to have to pay these guys or watch them leave like so many, you know, superstars before them, like Bell and Tomey and Ramirez and Sabathia and Lee, you know, got traded, of course, because they knew they wouldn't be able to resign.
Right.
They're going to have to pay these guys in the next 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. And the way that they do that, Jim, is by socking away the money that you make while the getting is good. And they ought to be packing that ballpark on a regular basis now and in 2018 if they continue to have a really solid team next year, so that when it's time to pay these guys, you don't have to watch them all go play for the Yankees or the Nationals or the Cubs or the Dodgers or other of the huge Boston or the huge market teams that are going to lure them and offer them these massive contracts. Now, I'm not under any delusion that they will be able to re-sign to long-term extensions, Kluber, Carrasco, who's also making peanuts, Santana next year, Bruce, who's a free agent at the end of the season. Who did I just mention already? Ramirez, Lindor. I'm not, you know, they can't. It's just that's the nature of the beast. You can't re-sign them all. But if you don't make the money while the making's good, if you don't pack the place when it ought to be packed, if you don't go from 24th to, you know, 9th in attendance or 5th in attendance, when you have this kind of a run and this kind of a team going, then you are essentially guaranteeing you're not going to be able to sign any of these guys. I mean, the timing of this is so crucial that they turn this winning streak and this season of being maybe the favorites to win the World Series, at least at this point, that they turn that into cash money. It is so incredibly important. And just to give you a little bit of an idea, Jose Ramirez, since I brought him up, Jose Ramirez has a $26 million contract. You think, wow, that's fantastic. Well, not really. That's for 5 years. That's for 5 years. He signed a contract that gave him a $2 million signing bonus. Two, not 20, $2 million signing bonus. His salary this season, you ready for this, Jim?
Go ahead.
$571,000. He's making $500,000 to maybe be the MVP of the American League. You know what he gets next year? Ooh, it's a huge jump, and it actually is a huge jump. It's about four times that amount, but it's $2.4 million.
Yep.
Then in 2019, it's 3.7. And then in 2020, it's 6.2. You understand the point here. MVP candidates are in the 15, 18, 20, $22 million range. He's at 2, 3, 6. 2021, 9. It's 2017, Jerry. That's 4 years from now.
Yep.
And he's a young player just growing into what he's going to be.
And, I have to give the front office
he's still mashing and doing what he's doing now in 2020. Yeah. He'll only make $6 million.
I do have to admit, I at least have to give the front office, on that one specifically, a whole tip of the cap. Because I believe that extension was signed this past spring.
Yes.
Where, if from a front office perspective, you're like, all right, you had that great season in 2016. We haven't seen evidence yet that you'll be able to keep going, or are you going to be the 220 hitter you were in 2014, right. 2015? So we're going to offer you this contract now. So then for these next 4 years, they're going to look like geniuses for that part of it.
He's 24 years old, by the way. No, well, he was with this offspring. I don't know when he turns 25. And he's locked up through 2023. They've got him for essentially six seasons because 2022 and 2023 are team options.
Yep.
And those are $11 and $13 million.
I think one or two of those years would have been his first true free agent year had they just let it go through normal arbitration
right.
stuff.
Now, this is a guy who is hitting .308 with a .927 OPS, 26 homers, 73 RBIs, 15 steals, and 94 runs. He is, without question, and he's played third base and second base with equal proficiency when needed when Jason Kipnis went down. He is easily one of the top MVP candidates. He is also one of the top WAR players in baseball if you do the advanced metrics
yep.
type things. Okay.
As he should be, I would think.
And he is getting paid next to nothing. Now, if you want to eventually pay the guys who need to be paid, and maybe there's going to come a time in the next 3 years if Jose Ramirez continues to do what he's doing, and he's an MVP candidate every year, and he's making six, while all the other candidates are making 24, there may be a holdout. There may be a we need to renegotiate. There may be a moment when the Indians want to do that, and they can't do it without the money. So that gets us back to the attendance now. And Crane's Cleveland business out there did this story. On Tuesday night, ESPN sports business reporter Darren Revelle told Cleveland, you got to do better than that. Same thing I told Matt Lodi 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
You got to do better than this. Now, he was referring to 24,000 on Tuesday night with Kluber on the mound and the chance to make the winning streak 20. And I brought it up to Lodi the same day, and I was talking at some of the weekend numbers, 18 and 21,000, even worse. You got to do better than that. I understand when the attendance is 9 and 11 and 12,000, when the team is in the garbage dump, But you always say, they always say, the fans always say, if you put a winner on the field, I'll come. And we'll spend that money. Okay, well, here we are. And they're 24th, 8 spots below Detroit. 8 spots below the Tigers. And how far are the Tigers out of first place? 26.5, 27.5 games? They're below Kansas City. So the point was, you know, the fans can do better. Well, here's the story, though. According to Crane's business in Cleveland, it's actually not as bad as it might seem. Beginning with a sellout crowd of 33.9 on July 4th, which is the 82nd game of the season, so right at about halfway point of the season, the last 32 home games have drawn an average of 27,584. That's an 81-game pace of 2.2 million, which would be comparable to their 2007 season total. During that span, they sold out 8 times and had 14 gatherings of 30,000. What stands out most, though, are the weekday crowds. On July 5th and 6th, they only drew 18,000 and 19,000 for Wednesday, Thursday games against the Padres. At the time, the Indians were 6 games above 500. They've played 14 home games on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday since. 7 of those have drawn at least 24,600, and only 2 have had crowds under 21.
Okay.
Big deal, right?
Yeah.
14 major league teams are averaging 30,000 plus at the gate this season. So that's no big deal, right? Well, for the Indians, it is. Analytics guru Jacob Rosen pointed out that the Indians played 56 weekday home games in September and October from 2010 to 2016. The average crowd on those days was 14,741. So then on Tuesday, as they mentioned, they had 24,000. Wednesday, 29,300. Those two games also produced the largest same-day ticket sales totals of the season as people realized, hey, they won again, the streak is still alive, let's go buy them on the spot. 4,523 and 5,430 respectively, and all are another big game. A big crowd will be on hand tonight, and I think this was for yesterday. I think this was for yesterday. No, because that was a daytime crowd, so it would have been this means for tonight. So, yes, the Indians should be playing before large crowds. And while these are not crowds the same size as you're going to get in a lot of other ballparks, you know, with a lot of other teams doing a lot of other things, when you are comparing the September weekday games, and the reason they make a point of September is school's back in session. So with weekday games or weeknight games, obviously, it's harder for a lot of fans to come out because your kids have school the next day and you don't want to be out till 11 o'clock at night, that sort of thing. But when they were averaging 14,000 to average over 24,000 now, plus 10,000 is a very, very big jump. And so they should be doing better, and they are doing better from what they normally do. The question is it fair to compare them not to themselves, talking about the fans out in Cleveland, you know, with this winning team? They went to the World Series Game 7, 10th inning last year, at home, by the way, to now having the longest winning streak in the history of the American League. Is it fair to compare them not to themselves, but is it fair now to compare them to other markets and other teams? From where I sit, they should be proud that they're getting 10 more than they were per game average over the last 6 years in September weekday games, and that's the metric that they studied. They should be proud of that. The fans are coming through with their promise of, hey, you said if we were good, or I'm sorry, we said if you were good, we would come. They are. To the tune of 10 grand more. But for me, 24th out of 30 teams, when you have the best team in the American League, maybe the best team in baseball, certainly the best record since in the second half, obviously the best record in the history of the American League in terms of this winning streak. Mm-hmm. You have all of that going. To me, plus 10 is good, plus 15, plus 18 to a sellout is more warranted. That's where I think this team needs to be on a regular basis, to stockpile the money, put it in the mattress, have the Dolans put it in the mattress. Then when Frankie Lindor comes up and the Yankees come a call him with a $200 million contract, the Indians can actually perhaps have something to counter with and say, you know what, we're going to do more for you than that. I mean, we might not be able to match them dollar for dollar, but we're going to make it very enticing for you to stay here and stay home. And that's I guess, where I want to end that, Jim. I just think it's plus 10, so it's not as bad as it might mm-hmm. seem. It's plus 10. It's better than what it had been for them in those same circumstances, but to me it's still not good enough given the current state of entertainment that you get from that team.
No, I hear you. And from here on in, it's essentially going to be a topic that does come up. The only wrinkle I'll throw in just for posterity's sake more than anything, and it works in terms of how much money the team is getting, and it also relates to even if their butts aren't in the actual seats at Progressive Field, it shows that the people are paying attention, and that is the ratings. I found this article that I went over, gosh, it was back in July, mid-July, like right after the All-Star break. I remember bringing this up. I was in for Mike Miller on one of the drive times, and this topic was coming up, and I found this. Mm-hmm. For what it's worth, and this is old data from a month and a half, almost 2 months ago now, the Indians are second in all of baseball in terms of local TV ratings, up 29% from a year ago. They are also, that plus 29 that they have is also third highest, you know, change from last year in all baseball, second or third only to the Yankees and Braves. And remember, in all the sports now, you do get more of your cash revenue flow from these TV contracts than you actually, in some respects, do from gate tickets at the gate.
Well,
just wanted to throw those out.
In some cities, you do.
True.
In some cities, you do. In some cities, the TV contracts are pennies. You know, in some
relatively
cities,
speaking,
they still rely
right
on the gate. And I think smaller cities like Cleveland, and they are in terms of, you know, baseball marketplace and in the media marketplace, they are a much smaller city than, for example, Detroit. Detroit's like, you know, market size 10 in radio and TV. In Cleveland, it's like 30. So, you know, it is still extraordinarily important to get the market, or excuse me, to get your attendance up to get the gate, because that's where you're going.
No, I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I'm just throwing that out there,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, no, and I think that is certainly fair to do. Okay, since you're talking about TV and you're talking about TV ratings, let's talk about sitting down and watching TV tonight. When the NFL returns for week number 2, it is going to be interesting to see if Deshaun Watson is added to too many fantasy football FanDuel rosters tonight. That's right. I'm going to watch, and I'm looking forward to it. You got a couple of teams that really had a struggle in week number 1. I'll be quite honest with you, I'm not a big fan of what Bill O'Brien did. Bill O'Brien decided to bench Tom Savage after 31 snaps and then give the ball to Deshaun Watson for the second half last week. Didn't do too much better in the Texans' opening loss, but he gets the start tonight. I'm going to hold off on putting him on my roster and in my lineup this week. That's the beauty of fantasy football, the FanDuel way. You can change your roster every single week. If you missed on a guy that you wanted to have in the lineup last week, you can put him in this week. And if you had a guy in the lineup last week who blew out, in David Johnson's case, it's a dislocated wrist, and he's done now, well, you don't have to worry about suffering through that loss. You just draft a new running back. The FanDuel way of playing fantasy football is the best way, because you do it every single week. It's for everyday fans like you and me. New contests start each week, so there's no busted seasons at all because of busted bones or anything like that. New contests, too, by the way, start at just $1. So if you're a newbie and you don't want to risk a whole lot, fine, play against other beginners. If you want to raise the stakes, you can do that, too. Just pick a contest, the one you like, that you're comfortable with. Choose your team and then watch your score in real time, and then maybe you can be among those, including over 2.5 million players who have won cash prizes playing fantasy football and fantasy sports on FanDuel. Here's what you do to play. Sign up right now. Go to FanDuel.com. You got your phone in your hands? Log on. FanDuel.com and click the Join Now button. Then put my name in, France, FRANTZ, as your code, because that's going to get you, as a new user, free entry into the NFL Sunday Million with over $1 million in cash prizes. But to get that free entry, you've got to use my name. Get to FanDuel.com. Use the promo code France, FRANTZ. That's FanDuel.com. Promo code France. Void where prohibited. Hey, Kush, I think it's time for a stat of the day.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents the Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day, and the theme of winning streaks. How about this? The Indians have a 21-game winning streak, but in their last 50 games, dating back to July 24th, they have a record of 39-11. That's a remarkable 50-game stretch, but not even close to the record. Heck, not even the best this season, because the Dodgers earlier this year had a 43-7 record in 50 games. But the best 50-game stretch for any team in history, that would be the 1906 Chicago Cubs, who once went 45-5 in a 50-game stretch during that season. That's your Buffalo Wild Wings wild stat of the day. Coming right back after this on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
The Extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Yeah, rolling on here at 3:45 now. Again, a lot of college football coming up in the second hour, and of course we have a lot of NFL football too. By the way, no matter what kind of football you want to watch, college or pro, you know the best place to watch it, right? Yeah, if you're not on your couch, you better be at B-Dubs. Buffalo Wild Wings all season long. They're going above and beyond to make every single location your football man cave. Countless taps and HD screens committed to the perfect atmosphere for watching football, food and drinks included, including the classic menu item in the 35th Weck sandwich and the limited time only Blue Moon barbecue sauce. But there's more. And you have to come in to find out what it is. To the place with the best football experience. Cannot tell you strongly enough about Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports. Please drink responsibly. Hey, Kush, you know, we're talking a lot of baseball here with the Indians, and that's fine. They certainly deserve all of the attention that they are getting. But there was a little bit of drama in the Indians' recent series, swept yesterday with against the Tigers, but it had nothing to do with wins and losses. It was another sweep. Of the Indians, their fourth time, I believe they swept the they shut the Tigers out four times this season. Beg your pardon. But it was a sweep, and that wasn't drama in terms of the competitive score. But there was drama with the umpire. What happened?
That one almost got away.
Oh, it got it.
Nailed it.
What happened? Yes.
John Hicks missed that pitch completely, and that might raise some eyebrows.
Boy, you're absolutely right. He didn't get a piece of that ball. That went right into the mask.
So, Jim, that's the Indians' television broadcast crew, Matt Underwood and Rick Manning, kind of suggesting that the Tigers threw intentionally at the umpire, did not even attempt to catch the ball, so they would drill him because they were ticked off because McCann and Ausmus had gotten thrown out arguing balls and strikes earlier.
Right, yeah, that's kind of where it started. It started with Ausmus and McCann. They got, as you mentioned, getting thrown out really only a couple batters earlier in that sequence for arguing balls and strikes. And their biggest beef that Brad Ausmus talked about post-game from that one was that you're not giving the same kind of calls. And then at one point, This was brought up. Now, there's no audio of this. He was talking to our good buddies Anthony Fennec and them over at the Free Press.
Yeah.
But Ausmus said, quote, and he would know this in a way because he had already been ejected and therefore back at the clubhouse. Quote, I heard the Indians broadcast. To imply that that was intentional is, first of all, a lie. If any player on this team intentionally tried to hurt an umpire, we deal with that severely. But for anyone to imply that that was intentional, that's completely wrong. They're out of line saying that, quite frankly. Buck Farmer, the pitcher in question, tweeted after the game, hate that people would think that I would hit the umpire intentionally. I have more respect for the game than that. Here's my thoughts on this so far, because I this has been bantied around by various people, especially nationally,
yeah,
since this game yesterday. Until more evidence comes out, I am going to give Ausmus and Buck Farmer the benefit of the doubt. But man, oh man, the thing really looked weird as it was happening. That you could
extrapolate.
Well,
for what reason then? If your eyes are telling you that it looked weird, what reason are you giving the benefit of the doubt?
Well, because on the one hand, you know, bases are already loaded. So if that ball gets away and misses the ump, it hits the batter at the time. I forget who it was at the plate. I think it was Encarnacion. Then that walks in a run, or that hit by pitch ends a run. Yeah, the Tigers are frustrated for a lot of reasons. We've seen some of that frustration boil over. See Brawl versus Yankees last month. But I got to believe these guys are a little more professional than that. And quite frankly, if there's any evidence that comes out later that suggests that, no, they did do that intentionally, forget waiting for this offseason. Brad Ausmus would then need to be fired on the spot, period. That's just something you don't do. You don't peg umpires like that.
Not at the big league level, you don't.
You sure as heck shouldn't.
I have seen this kind of thing happen in youth baseball. Perhaps you did as well. There was
not personally in my time as an umpire, but I've heard of these things happening.
No, yeah, I mean, it was a story. It was a national story from just, I want to say, earlier this season, a few months ago. There was a dispute over a call. And you know what it was, Jim? It was girls softball, but obviously fast pitch softball.
Right.
And there was a big dispute about some call or another, whatever it was, but you could see it. The catcher, literally, as the pitcher wound up, and this was right after a meeting on the mound, with the manager, the pitcher wound up and delivered one as hard and as high as she could get it, you know, right up near the umpire in the shoulder and chest and head level, and the catcher just dropped her mitt, okay? And it was clearly intentional. And I remember just there was a pretty big national. We talked about it very briefly on the show, but there was a pretty doggone big national
uproar. I'm starting to remember this.
To accuse somebody of doing that at the big league level, you doggone well better have evidence. Now, it should be pointed out, I don't believe, and you can play that again, I don't believe that the broadcast team accused them directly. They just said it looked kind of funny and it's kind of suspicious. And I'll say this. I can't remember another time when a major league catcher couldn't catch a fastball that was over the plate. I'm not talking about one that's so wide and outside they can't reach it and it goes to the backstop, wild pitch. I'm not talking about one that's in the dirt that they try to block and can't block. It was just a regular pitch.
Yeah.
It was over the plate. It was probably a little bit inside. But it was just a regular pitch that you catch. In fact, you know that it was over the plate because guess where the umpire is hunched? He's crouched down behind the plate. So I don't remember, and I really, truly am not going to try to accuse them of doing this intentionally because you don't have the evidence to make such an accusation.
Mm-hmm.
But I joined the broadcast team in saying, how do you not catch that? It's a regular pitch. It's coming right to you. Like I said, it's a little inside, but all he's got to do is move his glove over 2 inches, and he just catches the pitch, and we're in business. And he lets it go by, essentially, before sticking his glove out over to the inside part to catch it. And it drills the umpire clean. It wasn't like it nicked the glove. Now, that would be one thing. If it nicked the glove and then hit the umpire and knocked him down, and a broadcast team were to say, oh, that looks a little fishy, I'd say, what the hell is the matter with you? I mean, he tried to catch it. He just didn't react in time, and it went off his glove. But he didn't touch it. I just don't know how often that happens at this level, where a major league catcher, backup or not, where a major league catcher can't catch a fastball on the inside corner of the plate without it hitting the umpire first. I've never seen that before.
Right, and that's part of why it looks so weird when you're watching this, especially. And the other part that's leading some to say, well, maybe they were, is that immediately after that, you see John Hicks, the catcher, going out towards the mound, not even really looking back at the umpire in that case. Now, what the Tigers are saying, and again, until further evidence comes out, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, no matter how fishy this may have looked, is that also say, well, look, you know, we just got our catcher ejected, so Hicks is in there, and they got their signs mixed up. He was expecting a slider, not the fastball. And I really, at this moment, don't think it's intentional.
It does
because he just come into the game,
You know, if you look at the pitch, it does have a tail to it, and it does kind of, it kind of has movement where it starts out over the heart of the plate and then kind of tails high and up a little bit to the inside part of the plate, and maybe it crossed the catcher up, I suppose. But again, I'm just, you know, I've been watching baseball for a long time, and I don't recall a time when a pitch was just thrown right at the catcher, and it wasn't like, you know, so far that it was out of his reach, or in the dirt and hitting the dirt and then bouncing up past him and hitting an umpire. I just don't know the last time I saw a pitcher throw to the catcher and the catcher not being able to catch it.
Yeah.
It's just that simple.
Right, and we are at the major league level, so even if you get your signs mixed up, you know, one would think you'd still be able to recover. I mean, quirky things happen all the time in baseball. That's part of baseball. And I really want to give Brad Ausmus and the Tigers the benefit of the doubt. And I will have to do so again until further evidence comes out. But Tigers fans who would be defending them today, try to understand why a lot of other people are just thinking it looks fishy, because it was like the third or fourth pitch after both Ausmus and McCann were ejected.
Quite honestly, Jim, I don't think your fandom matters here. I don't care if you're an Indians fan or a Tigers fan, or if you're a White Sox fan who's happened to be watching a game that didn't involve your team. Anybody who's watched this, is going to have an opinion, and it's going to say that it looked weird. Even if they say, I don't think it was intentional, they're going to say, that's just trippy. That's just weird. How does a catcher not catch that? It wasn't
four
that
or five pitches after the ejections happened, and things like that.
Really, really high tempers flaring.
On a team that we know is frustrated as all get out with the Tigers this
year. Oh, yeah. No question. Let me hear it again. Brad Ausmus again said, you quoted it, and I'll read it again. Said, I heard the Indians broadcast to imply that this was intentional is, first of all, a lie. If any on the any player on this team intentionally tried to hurt an umpire, we'd deal with that severely. But for anyone to imply it was intentional, that's completely wrong, and they're out of line for saying it, quite frankly. Let's hear exactly what they said again.
That one almost got away.
Oh, it got it.
Nailed him.
What happened after? Yes.
John Hicks missed that pitch completely. And that might raise some eyebrows.
Boy, you're absolutely right. He didn't get a piece of that ball. That went right into the mask.
I think the part they're referring to is that when Matt Underwood goes, that might raise some eyebrows.
Right, but that's not an accusation.
Right.
And that's what I mean.
That's the other part. The partisan Indians guy in me is wanting to say, that's a little bit of a stretch to say, well, what that guy said, Underwood in this case, is accusing you. Now, that's a little bit of a stretch.
I think that's more than a stretch. I think that's really, really trying to read into it because you're frustrated and you're angry. I think that's accusing a guy of making an accusation that he didn't make. All Underwood said was, this is a few pitches after the ejection.
Yeah, it's like no more than five pitches in the next
batter.
He didn't
get a glove on it. He never even got a glove on the pitch. It's going to raise some eyebrows. That's all. That doesn't mean I think he did that on purpose. I mean, some people are going to say, huh. What do you make of that? That's all. And to ask that question, I don't think is out of line. All right, here's what else is not out of line. Winning tickets to the Big House. You want to go to the Michigan game against Air Force on Saturday? Stick around, because in about 20 minutes, after we talk to Paul Keels, the voice of the Buckeyes, how about that for a little symbiosis? We're going to go from the Buckeyes to the Wolverines by way of giving you tickets to the Michigan Air Force game. I'll have a chance for you to win it at about 4:20. Stay tuned. You'll hear how and when coming up right here on ESPN 106.5.
Ian Kinsler at the plate, 0-for-4 on the afternoon. Swings at the first pitch and a line drive to left field. Caught by Lonnie Chisenhall. It's over. 21 in a row. The Cleveland Indians have set a new record for the longest win streak in American League history.
I mean, I think they're enjoying themselves. They should. I think what's kind of cool about our game is when you do things and you do them the right way. You know, like with a hitting streak, somebody hits 3-0 when you're down 5 runs. And our guys are playing the game to win the right way. That part's really meaningful. They should enjoy what they're doing. It's pretty special.
Everybody's contributing, enjoying the game. Everybody's happy to be here. I really truly believe that they're capable of helping the team. And whenever they step into the play or they feel like they can do something to help the team that day, and that's exactly what we're doing.
Man, I couldn't be happier. I couldn't ask for any more. Man, I feel at home here. I feel like this, this is where I should be.
Yeah, I think when things aren't going well, you go back to fundamentals. It's so early in the season, though. We're going to be balanced. We're going to do whatever we have to do to go win this game. A lot of it's are we blocking them? Are they loading the line of scrimmage? No, we're going to do what we have to do to go win the game. We cannot be one-dimensional. We're working awful hard at that. I thought it went pretty well. Game one, struggled in the first half, but ended up with 600 yards and 49 points against on the road in a Big Ten game. Last week, I did not think it went well, so it's obviously a work in progress. You know, he is the primary play caller. We have to do better.
It's only two games into knowing the personnel, knowing what you guys do, or should it be better?
Should be much better.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It is indeed, and hour number two opens up at 10 minutes after 4. Really good stuff there at the top, obviously, of the montage. The Red Hot Indians with 21 in a row going for 22 against the Royals tonight. But right back into college football, you heard from Urban Meyer there. A little bit of his midweek take on where the Buckeyes are, trying to rebound from a drubbing at the hands of Baker Mayfield and Oklahoma and get ready for the challenge of Army coming up this Saturday. Joining us now to talk about it is the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes and the Buckeyes Radio Network, Mr. Paul Keels. Hey, Paul, thanks for the time this afternoon. How are you, sir?
I'm good, Bob. How you doing?
I'm good, my man. It's always good to catch up with you. All right, we're going to dive right into it because there's a lot of different places to go, none of them bigger than the JT Barrett question. And it's funny because, you and I have been talking about this, and I know you talk with a lot of people, and this subject has come up over the course of, well, really since last year, and maybe JT not playing as well or throwing the ball quite as well as perhaps he did a couple of years prior in his sophomore year when he kind of took college football by storm. But now the intensity is ratcheted up. It's red hot. People are pointing the finger of blame for the loss to Oklahoma right at JT Barrett, saying the offense's inefficiency is because of his inability to be accurate, particularly downfield. Is he taking an unfair amount of the criticism? And more importantly, how do you think Paul Keels, he handles that criticism going forward and trying to trying to refine his game?
I think it is a little unfair to JT that all of it fall on he. He would be the first person to tell you after a win or a loss that he needs to work at playing better. And how does it move forward is, hopefully it's JT playing better. It's the line blocking better. It's the receivers getting open better. I mean, this is a cumulative effect of a lot of things. And certainly it's frustrating when it's things that people saw against Michigan, saw against Clemson, and in the first half against Indiana. Here's the other thing to keep in mind too, Bob. There isn't a backup quarterback available at this point that's played in another game. So making a change really isn't an option. I mean, Dwayne Haskins has not played in a game yet this year. Joe Burrow is still maybe a week or two away from being able to play. He's the only other quarterback that's been in a game. So for this team to have any success, it's got to be JT Barrett. I think also you have to look and give Oklahoma's defense some credit for how well they played against him. But it's a little, this coaches will tell you it's all of the above. And, whether it's Kevin Wilson / Urban Meyer getting the right plays called at the right time, making the right adjustments. I think maybe the frustrating part is the good thing, and that's the fact that we've seen JT play better. So there's knowledge that it can operate better than it has, and it's got to.
That's a great point. You talk about a catch-22 there, or however you want to phrase that, but the frustration is we've seen him play better. We've seen him throw the ball better. We've seen him be more dynamic, more effective, and more efficient, and he's not now. So what does that mean? Is that a positive sign because we know he has it in him, or is it just that much more of a head-scratcher because where is that guy? How come he isn't playing the way he has played in the past?
I'm not sure, Bob. That's the million-dollar question. And here's another thing, and it kind of came to me while I was listening to your montage and we were on hold. When's the last time you can think that Ohio State began a season playing two teams like this? I mean, nobody's going to mistake Indiana for the 27 Yankees, but they're a better team than what usually Ohio State sees in week one or two, and then obviously Oklahoma is. You may have to go all the way back to 1986 when they opened against Alabama and Washington. These have been two sizable opening games when we're accustomed to seeing them play, no disrespect meant, whether it's a MAC school or whether it's somebody from a lower level of Division I. They're now getting into that point of the schedule where if things play out according to Hoyle, the pushback will be a lot less. But this has been two really rugged opponents that Ohio State's had to open the season with. And they've seen a lot of JT Barrett, and they've seen a lot of what this Ohio State offense has done over the years with him. So maybe some of it, let's give the opposing coaches credit for how well. And one of the things we're hearing, both Indiana and Oklahoma were doing a lot of dropping eight people. That really makes it hard to try and shove something in there when you've got eight people to be concerned about in pass coverage.
That's it. There's no doubt about that. And we can talk a little bit about the running game and how they let them get away with that. I mean, why didn't they run the ball more and more effectively to try to bring those guys up so that there could be more? But I guess we'll tie that into the Kevin Wilson question because, and whether Kevin Wilson truly believes what he said or if this is his way of taking some of the pressure and the criticism off of JT, but he said, this was on me. He said that yesterday, I believe it was. He said, this is on me. I've got to call a better game. He said, I've got to do a better job through practice, organization, and game calling to put the kids in better places. And some might say he's right. Angry fans might say, go ahead. We'll throw it on the coordinator. We'll throw it on the play caller. We'll throw it on somebody. But we're mad. We got to blame somebody. How much of that is Kevin Wilson, do you think, being accurate, that really there was a scheme and a strategy and an attack, a game plan issue, versus he's just trying to, kind of cover for his kids?
Well, I wish I could tell you that I knew for sure, Bob, but I think that it's a guy and it's an experienced coach, both as a head coach and a coordinator, that is trying to probably, this is just guesstimating, take the pressure off of his players. We've seen what Kevin Wilson's offenses at Indiana have looked like for the last 6 years, certainly what they looked like at Oklahoma when he was the coordinator there, and even previous to that at Northwestern. So, and we all kind of really salivated thinking about what was this marriage of Kevin Wilson and JT Barrett and the rest of this offense going to show. And the running game is a big part of that. I think we saw Saturday night some signs that J.K. Dobbins was having some success running the ball. Mike Weber didn't run it as much, and we kind of learned that he may have tweaked that hamstring a little bit. You know, the other question there's not an answer to, we haven't really seen JT run the way we have in the past. And, you know, maybe that's something that will develop further down the road. But certainly, you know, somebody's...
Paul, do you mean on design runs or his lack of willingness to get out and run it to make a play if he doesn't see what he wants early?
I'm guessing design runs. And, you know, and who knows if some of this also is the fact that, you know, what we addressed earlier, they're sitting right now with a backup quarterback that's never played in a game. So, you know, who knows how much if that's even part of the equation at all. So, you know, I think we're kind of anxious to see what adjustments do they make. You know, football is a game of such adjustments. You know, we know that Kevin Wilson can make adjustments. You know, how is the whole line of communication between he and Ryan Day, the new quarterback's coach, and Urban Meyer, who, you know, has always been kind of an offensive-oriented, the way we've led to believe, head coach. So, you know, that could be part of the process, too. But, you know, Kevin Wilson's an experienced guy, and if he thinks that taking the bullet is going to take the pressure off of his players, then, you know, he wouldn't be the first experienced coach to do that.
Paul Keel's joining us talking about the Ohio State loss to Oklahoma. Baker Mayfield was just spectacular. I want to get into a question about that against the Buckeyes pass defense in a second, but back to the running game. And I certainly don't mean to question Urban Meyer's depth chart in any way. We know that J.K. Dobbins had a tremendous debut against Indiana, and he was going to get a bunch of carries. As you pointed out, it looks like maybe Mike Weber tweaked that hammy again. But I'm still wondering about other guys like DeMario McCall. Is he injured? Because I haven't seen his number called in each of the first two games. Is he healthy or is he not?
He was dealing with a sports hernia issue, and I believe there was a procedure. I don't know when, Bob. He was on the field once at Indiana in a punt return situation, and I believe that's the only time that DeMario has been on the field. So I think there's still some concern about a sports hernia issue, because if you'll recall, further down the depth chart at Indiana, we saw Antonio Williams get out there, and he scored a couple of touchdowns in short yardage situations. And, you know, I think there's some faith in him. The order just didn't get that far down Saturday against Oklahoma. Okay. But McCall's that's the question. Yeah, he dealt with at some point in time in the summer with a sports hernia.
Yeah, and I've got no reason to push him over anybody else. It's just that, you know, he was kind of counted on, I think, in the spring and then during camp to really be a, you know, an H-back kind of a playmaker, a slot guy, a running back, doing a little bit of everything. And in an offense that is begging for some explosiveness right now, I would just think he might be able to provide some of that. So I thought there must be something to it, and perhaps that is it, the sports hernia. Paul, let's talk about the pass defense. If you want to find the Ohio State pass defense in the national rankings, just scroll to the bottom of the page.
Yes.
Dead last, 130th in the country after the two games against Indiana and, of course, Baker Mayfield, who is a decided step up for Oklahoma this week. It's not always going to be that way, but it is that way now. What are you seeing in that secondary? What are you seeing? Maybe it's not the secondary. Maybe it's the lack of a pass rush. Maybe it's just great competition. But to what do you attribute 130th and dead last in the nation right now?
Well, I think you attribute it to two offenses that did a great job moving the football up and down the field in Indiana and Oklahoma. And Bob, I'd be hard-pressed right away to think of an opposing quarterback that's coming in played at Ohio Stadium as well as Baker Mayfield did. I mean, you might have to go back to Juice Williams. Jim Lachey even went as far back as referencing when John Elway played against Ohio State at Stanford. This kid came in and played much better than anybody expected. The way he was able to kind of scramble and slide around and keep plays open. And I think that was kind of part of what really made it difficult for this defensive secondary. Just when they thought maybe they had him flushed or he was going to move or do something, Mayfield was able to be mobile enough that as he got out of his initial movements, he was able to, you know, rear back and find receivers, you know, spreading the ball around to, you know, tailbacks as well. You know, they had a tight end who was hurt in the first half, who's an outstanding one, but a second tight end in Calcaterra that played very well. So I think there was some pass rush there. Oklahoma maybe has the best offensive line in the country. That kind of helps with a situation like that. But I think it's a secondary that, you know, young is something that nobody wants to use and inexperienced as an excuse. But, you know, you're talking about a secondary that's replacing three NFL draft picks. Guys that have been on the field quite a bit with Ward and Damon Webb and Damon Arnett. Young guys like Sheffield and Okuda and Fuller. But it's just a simple matter of getting their heads turned and making a play. And, and trying to do so against a good offense and being able to make a play that can turn a game around much like that secondary did last year very often.
You know, question about it. And last thing on them and him, Baker Mayfield, did you have any problem with the planting of the flag? He was quick to apologize, I think, on Monday for it, saying no disrespect, excitement, this is what we do at our place, and he did it at their place. Any problem with that?
Well, trying to plant a flag in the field turf wasn't a smart move. He was smart that he waited until the Ohio State football team got in the locker room. But, you know, not really. I mean, they make a big deal out of their flag thing and their Texas rivalry. The apology was more likely prompted by head coach, athletic director, university president, something like that. I think he was being a company man. But, you know, somebody else said, I can't take credit for, somebody else said, if you're Ohio State and you're upset with it, the option is don't lose the game and don't give him the opportunity to do that. But, you know, hey, he had an outstanding performance and, you know, he deserves a lot of credit for it. I don't know about planting the flag, but, you know, hey, that was his move.
No question about it. And you know what? If there is room for doubt there, he earned the benefit of the doubt to do what he wanted to do there, because he pretty much did lay claim to the Ohio Stadium for at least one night. Okay, last thing. Let's look at Army real quick, Paul. What can you tell us about the matchup Saturday?
Well, this is much like we talked about with Navy. Triple option, wishbone. It's a difficult offense because you don't see it very often. Offensive linemen, cut blocking defensive linemen. And think here's the thing for you to chew on, Bob. Last week when they came from 10 down to beat Buffalo, they held Buffalo in the second half to only 3 drives, 16 plays, and 48 yards. When they get rolling with a wishbone, it's basically a game to keep away. You don't see it very often. Ohio State's been kind of practicing it a little bit since the spring. So it's a completely different animal, and that's what will make it exciting to watch.
It will indeed, and you'll be on the call. Paul Keels will have it for you right here on the Ticket and on the Ohio State Radio Network. Paul, great conversation as always. Thanks for the update on all things Buckeyes. We'll talk to you again next week.
You got it, Bob. Have a good weekend.
You got it. All right, it is 4:22 now, and we're going to go from college football to college football, but from Big Ten, well, to Big Ten. But there's got to be something different here, right? Oh, yeah, from Ohio State to Michigan. I'm going to wrap up the Ohio State conversation with Paul Keels by giving away Michigan tickets. That doesn't seem fair, does it? Yeah, here's what I want to do, Cushlin. Get me 2 callers on the line. We're going to go head-to-head the way we did with Lions tickets earlier, right before the start of the NFL season. I've got a pair of Michigan tickets to go and see the Wolverines taking on Air Force Saturday at the Big House. And I will give those tickets to the winner of our trivia contest. And we're going to have one player against another. Whoever answers it with the answer closest to the correct answer will be going to the Big House for the game on Saturday against Air Force. That is going to be an awful lot of fun. So while Jim takes care of that business, I take care of this business. Who are you starting at quarterback for your fantasy team on FanDuel this week? The NFL season starts tonight. I can pretty much tell you it will not be Mr. Watson. Deshaun Watson is going to be a very good pro, I really believe, but they really pulled the trigger too early. Bill O'Brien did in Houston on Tom Savage. I think they should have given Tom Savage at least a few starts to try to work through whatever it is the offense there has to work through. They gave him 31 snaps, gave the ball to Deshaun. Deshaun is going to be great, but he is not ready yet. I think I can say that. If you're looking for a great bargain, even though he's very expensive, I'm going to stay with Matt Stafford. Matt Stafford continues to put up numbers. He got the biggest contract, and he lived up to it, obviously, in week 1 with 4 touchdowns against the Cardinals. And I like what I see, and I like his chances against the New York Giants. Did you see what the Cowboys did to the Giants, for crying out loud, in week number 1? If you're looking for an almost surefire thing, pick Matthew Stafford is your quarterback on FanDuel this week. That's the beauty, by the way, of FanDuel. You can pick your quarterback, your running back, your defense, all of your playmakers each week. And if somebody lets you down or if somebody gets hurt, change it the next week. No big deal. That's the beauty. No busted seasons when you're playing fantasy football on FanDuel. There's lots of contests to choose from, too. Something for everybody, starting at just $1. Choose your contest. Be as risky as you want to be. Choose your team, then watch your score in real time. Over 2.5 million players have won a cash prize playing fantasy football on FanDuel. Sign up now at FanDuel.com with the promo code France, and you could, if you're a new user, get a free entry into the NFL Sunday Million. That's over $1 million in cash prizes when you make your first deposit on FanDuel. Just visit FanDuel.com and sign up with the promo code France. That's FanDuel.com, promo code FR. ANTZ. Spell it right or you don't get the deal. Void where prohibited. That's FanDuel Fantasy Football. Okay, now let's go right back into it. I want to get these Michigan tickets. Hold on, Kush. Let me attempt and sweeten the pot a little bit by telling you where they are. Hold on a second. The tickets for the game at the Big House against Air Force Saturday, Section 41, Row 39, seats 3 and 4, and they are free to the winner of this trivia contest. It looks like we've got both of them on the line.
As opposed, by the way, to the $70 retail that I'm seeing on the ticket itself.
So those are good seats.
Yes.
That's daggone nice if you want to go to the Big House and watch the Wolverines. Okay, Luke in Perrysburg is with us. He's on line one. Luke, are you there?
Good. How are you?
I'm good, man. Are you a big Michigan fan?
No, I'm a Toledo Rocket fan, but I love football in general.
Love that. That's good. I like that a lot. And let's go to Troy, who's in BG. I'm going to guess he's a Bowling Green State Falcons fan, first and foremost, but he wants to go to Michigan, too. Are you there, Troy?
Yes, I am.
And you are a Falcons fan, yes?
Yep.
How about this? So we got a Rocket versus a Falcon for Wolverine tickets.
Oh, that's appropriate.
That's perfect. All right, gentlemen, here's the way it's going to go. I'll ask Luke first, and I'll ask you second, Troy. The answer to the question, whoever's closest to the correct answer will be our winner. And it is Michigan trivia, as you can imagine, and it's this way. Since we're talking about winning streaks these days on the program and really all over the country with the Indians having 21 wins in a row, what is the longest winning streak, gentlemen, for Michigan football in the history of the Michigan-Ohio State rivalry? How many games in a row did Michigan win over Ohio State in their longest stretch? Luke, you're first. What do you think?
I'm going to go with 8.
You're going to go with 8 games. That's the longest streak ever for Michigan over Ohio State. And, Troy, what do you say?
I'm sorry. I didn't hear what he said.
He said 8. He said 8 is the longest streak. What do you say?
I'm going to go with the Price is Right answer and go with 7.
Well, that's well played, but unfortunately for you, good sir, you went the wrong direction with your Price is Right answer because the correct answer is 9. 9 right. Straight wins.
And you dig
it! You're supposed to, when you go on Price is Right, you go one over what the other guy bid, not under it.
I can't believe that Michigan was ever that successful. So.
Well, here's a reason. There's a reason why you can't remember it. You want to know when it was? 1901 to 1909. That was their 9-game longest ever winning streak against Ohio State. That's why you couldn't remember it. Hey, Troy, thanks for playing, brother. Appreciate it. Luke in Perrysburg, hold the line, my friend, all right? We got tickets for you. We'll get your information and tell you how you can pick those up, all right?
Okay, thank you.
All right, congratulations. There you go. So we got Michigan tickets. And by the way, speaking of winning, how about $1,000, your chance at $1,000 4 times a day? It's coming up, the 4K day. Contest starts, well, actually, it starts today. What am I saying, for crying out loud? 4 times a day, it starts today, the 14th. For some reason, I thought this started tomorrow. But you have a chance at $1,000 4 times a day right here on ESPN 106.5, the ticket, 4 times a day starting today. And that'll be going until, I can't remember exactly when. But I'll tell you when. It does start today. All right, here's what we'll do. We'll get a timeout here, bottom of the hour, Sports Center. On the other side, we're going to talk more college football. The head coach of the UT Rockets, Luke's favorite team, is Jason Candle. And he's coming up to talk to Jim Cushlin about the Rockets matchup against Tulsa, which will be at the Glass Bowl coming up on Saturday. That conversation still to come right here on the ticket.
Now, back to Bob France, ESPN 106.5, the ticket.
And welcome back into the extravaganza. Jim Cushlin here talking some college football here on this Thursday. Already talked some Buckeyes, talked Falcons earlier in the week, Michigan as well, and Notre Dame. Now it's time to get a little bit of info on the Toledo Rockets. A 37-24 win this past Saturday on the road at Nevada. Back at the Glass Bowl this Saturday to take on Tulsa. They are 2-0 now, are the Rockets on this young season. To help us break it all down, we welcome back to the program the head coach of the Toledo Rockets, Jason Candle, joining us on the program. Hi, Coach. How you doing?
Doing great, Jim. How are you?
Not too bad, not too bad. And you guys are doing pretty good right now, 2-0, 37-24 again at Nevada. And the first thing that jumps out at me of this one, Coach, senior leadership helping take over. Logan Woodside, 19-27, 232, 2 touchdowns. You got Terry Swanson, 101 on the ground, 2 scores himself. Cody Thompson, 101 on 8 catches and a score. It must make things a lot easier when your seniors, your senior leadership, particularly these skill positions on offense, are really picking up the slack and helping things go forward.
Well, I think that's the goal of any program. You're good players in order for you to take the next step to go from good to great and accomplish the goals that these young people have set out for themselves, both individually and collectively as a team. You have to, your best players have to play the best when it matters the most. And, you know, I think if we can get consistency from that class, that senior class, and that group of young people that we feel are, you know, potentially good players or great players down the road to support those seniors, that's what we're looking for, to make sure we have the success that we want as a team.
And again, it certainly helped in this situation, in this game. It helped you guys go up a little bit early. You had some defensive things that we'll get to in this particular game. And I love the time of possession. 40 minutes for you guys on offense, just 19:45 on offense for Nevada. When you control the ball and have these kind of playmakers, especially starting with the seniors that we just mentioned, it's got to make things a lot easier going through a game like this.
Well, I think you mentioned the time of possession, and I think, you know, the big key there was coming out of half in the third quarter, taking the first drive and going down and scoring, and then, you know, getting the second possession of the third quarter and doing the same. And, you know, I think the time of possession, we were over 13 minutes out of 15 in that quarter. You know, then you flip it to the fourth quarter and you have the ball 11 minutes there. So, you know, when you possess the football and you have it in your hands, the other team, you know, they were a wide open passing style team, and they could, you know, had the potential to hit a big play at any time. So when you can control the game, you know, the clock, you can, you know, control the game too. So we usually, you know, play with good tempo and play fast on offense ourselves, which we were able to still do that in the second half. But yet I thought we picked up some really key third down conversions and stayed ahead of the chains. We were in third and four and third and five a lot instead of third and nine and 10. You know, which your rate of success goes way up when you're in those manageable yardage situations. So credit to our seniors, credit to our coaches for, you know, doing a good job in the second half and getting things flipped around and adjusted at halftime, and then our players going out and doing a really good job executing at eye level.
We're talking with head coach of the Toledo Rockets, Jason Candle. Rockets 2-0 on the young season after they get a win this past Saturday, 37-24 at Nevada. And, you know, in addition to that, coach, in that second half you're referring to, those two long touchdown drives, holding the ball for that long, not only are those things that help your defense because it keeps them a little bit rested, they forced a couple of turnovers in this game. You guys had a goose egg in terms of turnovers, which is always what you want to see. But they're the kind of things that to an opponent, especially their building, it really takes the wind out of their sails. It really does, especially as you point out that usually the Rockets are a more faster team, you know, on offense. So to take those kind of long drives like that, that's just got to make you smile.
Well, we took their punches. You know, they attempted an onside kick in the first half. We recovered it. We blocked the punt. You know, we turned them over a couple times. And, you know, then in the second half, you consistently throw your own punches, and you're able to go ahead and score at the end of those drives. Like you said, that is deflating. That is, hey, we give these guys our best shot. They held off, and they didn't crack under the pressure of some of our trick situations and things that they tried to do. And, you know, they gave us their best. We hung in there. We did give up a few plays, and they did land a few of those punches they threw at us. But we were able to keep fighting and keep going. And, you know, I think a big emphasis here in our football program is handling adversity. And it's not easy to go across the country to play a football game against anybody, you know, and certainly dealing with the time change and the time of day the game was and playing in the heat and the altitude and all those things that are built-in excuses for you to go lose the game. Our guys didn't buy into any of that. They just kept fighting and kept playing, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, no doubt about it, Coach. Not only that, but, you know, you go up early in terms of, 17-3 after quarter. Then you come out, as you mentioned, and we've been mentioning now, after halftime and have those long drives. So it tells me that in addition to all that, your guys totally had the right mindset going into to this game on the road with all the things that you were just talking about, and come away with a win like this shows how good I think this team can be down the line.
Yeah, we have a lot of things that we certainly have to correct. I mean, there were a lot of, you know, we had some missed assignments like you would in any of the first couple of games you play, and we had, you know, some head scratching, you know, penalties that, you know, just infuriate me and make me want to, you know, go crazy on the sidelines. So, you know, those things are things that must get corrected if we want to even have a chance moving forward here. But for the most part, handling the trip, setting out and getting done what we set out to do, accomplishing the main goal. Go out there, win the football game, come back, get ready to go play a great opponent this week. You know, check all the boxes on those things. We were able to do that. But we got a long way to go yet.
And I'm sure as a head coach, there are other things you could probably nitpick on, but 13 penalties, 105 yards. Got away with it, obviously, in this one, but it might not be so fortunate if that penalty number is like that. Would you say that's the biggest thing that annoyed you from this win?
Yeah, that's ridiculous. 13 penalties is crazy. You know, I think it may actually have been 14, but, you know, that's crazy, and, you know, that's not who we are. That's not who what we want our program to look like. You know, we preach accountability. We preach discipline. We preach all these things. You know, that's why we have the highest APR in our conference. That's why we have a team GPA that's just a hair under a 3.0. Those are all things that are your direct correlations to having a disciplined program, disciplined people who are willing to do the right thing every day, you know. And I thought we had a pretty good week of practice last week, and then to go out and have some unforced things, penalties, couple errors, that's discouraging. And again, like I said, that's not who we are at the core. If this was a place that, you know, where there was a bunch of undisciplined people in that locker room, it would be a different story. But that's got to get fixed.
We're talking with head coach Jason Candle of the Toledo Rockets here on the Extravaganza. Jim Kuslin with you as well. Rockets now 2-0, 37-24 they win at Nevada. Back on Saturday, now coming up this Saturday, back home at the Glass Bowl, friendly confines, 7 o'clock the kickoff time against Tulsa, a decent American Athletic team. They are 1-1 on the year. What can you tell us about them?
Well, an offense that gained almost 700 yards Saturday in their game against Louisiana Lafayette. Over 400 yards rushing as a team, you know, a back that ran for almost 300 yards, big time offense, you know, a team that is coming off of a 10-win season last year, program that understands how to win, and certainly, you know, what is under great leadership by, you know, a good young coach, and certainly, you know, I think we'll definitely have our hands full. We have to, you know, stop their wide open style of offense and the attack that they bring to the table. You know, they're going to make you defend the field vertically and spread it out as well, play with great tempo. I think they're leading the country in number of snaps per game that they get on offense, or something like 94, 95 plays a game, which is unheard of. So they line up and they want to snap it as many times as they can, and usually teams that have that philosophy, they think they're pretty good to be able to want to do that. So we've got to be able to handle that. We've got to be able to stop that. And then defensively, you know, they're a four-down team, that, you know, which the last couple teams we've played have been odd fronts, and just another wrinkle that's just enough to mess with you and screw your communication up. So we've had a good week of practice of making the adjustment and getting back to more of a familiar front. So, you know, we'll see. But our guys got to become ready to play, locked into the details of what that game plan looks like, and play really hard, and hopefully we have a great crowd in the Glass Bowl.
And obviously, based on what you said there, Coach, it sounds to me like this is a game where your defensive front seven is going to have to make some noise, have to put some pressure on the quarterback, and certainly not let them get anywhere near the 400 yards of rushing in their last outing that you were talking about. So would I be incorrect in saying that this game is going to have to start defensively for you with that front seven?
Well, I think it always comes down to stopping the run. And yeah, if we give up 400 yards of rushing, this is not going to be a fun phone call next week. You know, that's the reality of it. You know, you gotta be able to fit your gaps. You gotta be able to stop them and make them one dimensional and make them, turn them into a passing team. You know, whoever you're playing, not necessarily just Tulsa, but any team that you play, if you allow big, you know, explosive plays in a run game, that's deflating, you know, and now you start to guess and try to patch up holes, and when you start doing that, more show up. So, you know, we got to be just fundamentally sound. We got to tackle really well. I think one thing these guys do a really good job of doing is getting your guys in space, and they force you to become disciplined in your tackling technique and making sure you get guys on the ground. If not, they have enough skill that can break, you know, long plays, and you know, we certainly don't want that to happen. So discipline and our attention to detail will definitely be challenged this week, that's for sure.
The Toledo Rockets back at the Glass Bowl this Saturday night, 7 o'clock kickoff time as they welcome in Tulsa. Coach, best of luck up to you and your guys out there on Saturday. And let's hope we're talking about a third straight Rockets win to start this season when we reconvene next week.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it.
That is head coach of the Toledo Rockets, Jason Cantle, joining us here on the Extravaganza. And you heard him, Tulsa, they may be 1-1 on the year, but they have some offensive firepower. They were a 10-win team out of the American Athletic a season ago, which, depending on who you talk to, and I guess this would include myself as well, the American Athletic, probably the best of the five mid-major conferences in college football right now. Of course, those are the American, Mountain West, MAC, Conference USA, and Sun Belt. I pretty much said them in the order that I would rank them, and if the tops of the Mountain West continue to struggle, then I might have to make the MAC the second best conference. So this is a solid team from a solid conference. It's not a major conference, but you know, it still takes a lot to win 10 football games in a season. That's what Tulsa was able to do last year, and again, 1-1 so far this year. Is Tulsa, yeah, it was the 66 they put up against Louisiana Lafayette. They gave up 59, though, in their opening game loss at Oklahoma State, who was 10th ranked at the time, you know, out of that Big 12. So they've already seen a tough opponent on the road. This, for their perspective, will be another tough opponent, but no offense to our Rockets, not on the level of an Oklahoma State, but obviously, as we know, if the offense gets going, and I really liked from that game this past Saturday against Nevada for the Rockets, and brought it up there, what you heard with Coach just a few minutes ago. They get out to the early lead. The seniors with Woodside, Swanson, and Thompson specifically, your quarterback, main running back, top wide receiver, all putting up huge numbers. And then in the second half, when the game is still, you know, a possibility. I mean, after all, it was only a 13-point win, 37-24 for Toledo. But then to go out in the second half and have just back-breaking long drives that result in scores to make the time of possession seem even more ridiculous, that shows the versatility to me of this Rocket offense. We know what they're capable of, and just thinking of some of these numbers, we know what the Tulsa defense is capable of, which is the Rockets could do some damage there. So yes, it sounds simple and cliche, but the beginning of this game and the thing that's going to decide it the most is going to be what the Rockets are able to do on the front seven. They have to turn this team, as your coach, more one-dimensional, get some pressure on the quarterback, and certainly do what they can to contain Tulsa's run game, which went wild against the Raging Cajuns last week. So this is not an easy ball game by any stretch of the imagination for the Rockets. This is not like 2 weeks ago when Elon came in. And I like the steady increasing of opponents in this out-of-conference portion of the schedule before they hit the MAC portion coming up against Eastern Michigan to start October. You get Elon. That's a 1AA FCS school in your building. So it is that tune-up, warm-up game. Get everything in line. Then you go out almost to the West Coast. Nevada's in Reno. That's basically the border with California. So basically to the West Coast. You get a big win there in the way we all just described. Then it's Tulsa. A no slouch of a team that won 10 games, granted not in a power conference, but still a 10-game winner last year. And then it's off to the U, a ranked team, and a team that I foresee will still be ranked unless they get their doors blown off this weekend. They'll still be a ranked team, will Miami, next Saturday when the Rockets go down to the U. So all the opponents getting steadily better as each week of the out of conference goes by. I love how this is set up. This is no means an easy game, but at least the Rockets, you know, will get it at the glass ball. And that's going to do it for this Thursday edition of the Extravaganza. Thanks so much for hanging out with us today. Mike Miller on Drive Time coming at you next. And then it is Thursday, so we got some NFL Week 2 action starting tonight. 7:30 the coverage time, courtesy of our friends at Westwood One. Houston Texans against the Cincinnati Bengals. We'll have that for you as we start Week 2 of the NFL. So lots and lots of football really starting today, and we'll talk about all that and get you ready for a free-for-all football Friday tomorrow. Get you ready for high school, college, the NFL, and much, much more. But don't go away. Mike Miller on Drive Time coming at you next. We'll reconvene to talk about all the fun football and stuff tomorrow. See ya.